watch anything. Watch it forevermore. That's what friends are for. That's what friends are for.
Bravo, bravo.
Warmongers, tech oligarchs, and big media collusion. Oh my! So it appears the BBC is launching attacks on journalists for exposing the white helmets and for calling attention to the fake chemical attacks. Apparently, Vanessa Bealey has been attacked by some media hack from the BBC. My Twitter thread just now. This is Vanessa. Thread: I will be now going on the offensive. Press freedom is at stake. Hashtag Assange has set the dangerous precedent for treatment of journalists who expose UK/US war crimes. This must not be allowed to become the norm. A BBC hack is now threatening potential legal action against me for exposing white helmets as Al-Qaeda auxiliary. If the white helmets are embedded with Al-Qaeda in occupied hospitals and involved in persecution of civilians, they make themselves a legit target for liberating forces. Apparently, the BBC doesn't want anyone to say that. So Vanessa stands by her statements to that effect. This was the threat from the BBC, that you call the white helmets a legit target in order to back the right of the Syrian and Russian military in their efforts to bomb them. Damn straight. One lawyer who we have spoken to tells us that someone who spends time with Syrian ministers and who is publicly calling for humanitarian workers to be bombed may be liable to face charges of aiding and abetting, inciting, or conspiring to commit a crime under international law. This could appear to apply to you. Do you have anything you wish to respond to this? Her email includes: you promote a story of the war in Syria in which the Syrian and Russian states are victims of a huge Western conspiracy involving the White Helmets and James Lemessurier. The problem is, with Vanessa, is she's telling the truth. This is what's actually happening. It's not a conspiracy theory. So the hack BBC person continues, that you are an anti-establishment activist who has devoted a lot of your time over the last few years to the idea that James Lemessurier was a Secret Service agent running a fake group of rescue workers in Syria. Ding, ding, ding. That you contribute to and spread conspiracy theories. No. That the Russian government and Russian-funded and controlled media such as RT and Sputnik Radio have helped promote you and your ideas. We've gone over this before with Lee Camp. The reason they turned to RT and Sputnik for funding these journalists on the left is because there isn't anybody in the United States who will fund them. And the media in the United States act just like the media in the United Kingdom. They're actively seeking to control the narrative and keeping voices such as Vanessa's from making any noise. I hadn't advanced my screen yet, so let me read it. That the Russian government and Russian-funded and controlled media such as RT and Sputnik Radio have helped promote you and your ideas. That the Syrian government has provided you with visas and state escorts and suggested places you could visit. They do that for all journalists, including the BBC. Now here's a good one. That you were motivated by the suffering of children during your experiences in Gaza. Well? That you have expressed anti-Semitic views. Now let me talk about that for a second. So Semitic means from the original 12 tribes of Israel. And most modern Jews are not Semitic. They haven't descended from those 12 tribes if you look at their DNA record. So what the BBC hack is trying to say is that Vanessa is anti-Zionist. And it's not the same thing, people. Anti-Semitic is not the same as anti-Zionist. I myself am anti-Zionist, and I am no way anti-Jewish people, but I'm also in no way anti-Palestinian people, and therein lies the rub. So if you say openly that the Jewish state is an apartheid state, duh, you're going to be branded anti-Semitic, even though you're not. So I'll start that one over. That you have expressed anti-Semitic views, including blog posts and images posted on social media. that you see Britain as the corrupting force behind a lot of the horror in the world. We have investigated many of your claims, oh I'm sure, in relation to the White Helmets and James Lemessurier, for example, that White Helmets fake their rescue videos, they do, or that James Lemessurier and the White Helmets were involved in organ trafficking, found them not to have any substance. I'm sure they found them not to have any substance, even though they are true. She goes on, that you self-identify as a journalist, although you have no formal training and do not conduct yourself with the rigor of a professional journalist. LOL, rigor is obviously producing fake reports to manufacture consent for regime change war. Phew, glad I don't measure up. And this goes on, this garbage, this cod swallop goes on and on. So I'll let you read it for yourselves. I'll post it underneath the video here. And now on to the main course, two articles by Caitlin Johnstone. The first is, how did people have conversations back before tech oligarchs were there to police them? Twitter has announced the rollout of even more censorship policies in the lead up to the November US presidential election. Starting next week, when people attempt to retweet a tweet with a misleading information label, they will see a prompt directing them to credible information about the topic before they can amplify it, Twitter informs us, with credible information, of course, meaning information from the same mass media outlets who've lied to us about every American war throughout their entire existence. We're taking more steps to encourage thoughtful amplification by preventing tweets that have been followed by and liked by accounts you don't follow from showing up in your timeline, adds Twitter, as though the social media echo chamber that is turning us all into idiots wasn't bad enough. Here's a Ben Norton tweet. Get ready for even more censorship of Twitter in the name of election integrity. This is just the latest in a stack of additional censorship measures that Silicon Valley tech corporations have been rolling out in open coordination with the US government under the banner of protecting American democracy. We may be certain that none of these measures will be rolled back when the election is over. As my regular readers are no doubt tired of hearing me repeat by now, when you have monopolistic tech corporations which attract the bulk of online communication, coordinating with governments to censor speech, what you have is government censorship. As Matt Taibbi recently wrote after the irrational Facebook purge of QAnon cultists, this censorship regime is continually expanding, and this expansion is likely to continue, especially in the direction of those who oppose these same establishment power structures that are promoting this censorship. It's just so brazenly authoritarian. The only reason people are putting up with it is because they've spent 4 years being bombarded with horror stories about Russian propaganda and right-wing disinformation by the same plutocratic media institutions that are now being upheld as authoritative sources. But the fact that consent has been successfully manufactured doesn't make it okay. Imagine if you were at a party and a bunch of guys with clipboards who work for the government were going around from group to group listening to the conversations people were having and forcibly removing anyone who said anything they deemed false or disruptive. Would you be okay with this? Even if the people they dragged out of the social gathering were saying things that were indeed false? Of course you wouldn't. Nobody would find such an occurrence acceptable, but because basically the same thing is happening on the relatively unfamiliar conversation forum known as social media, people accept the authoritative voices of the plutocratic punditry who are telling them it's normal. This is a Matt Taibbi tweet. This current system is non-transparent, invites government recommendations on speech, allows a gameable system of anonymous complaints to influence content, and gives awesome power to an unelected, unaccountable body of private media regulators. Well, it's not normal. How do people think conversations happened back before there were monopolistic tech oligarchs policing their words in coordination with the government to make sure they weren't hazardous to democracy? Did they forget that this wasn't something that used to happen? Do they think before online political discourse, people used to have to meet at the FBI headquarters to have a Fed supervise their conversation if they wanted to debate whether or not a conspiracy theory is true? No, people just talked to each other. Sometimes what people said was true, sometimes it was false, Sometimes it was an idiotic urban legend about a Hollywood celebrity putting rodents in their butt. But at no time did anyone stop and think they needed a team of billionaires and government agents to jump in and police their conversations for them. It's abnormal. It's insane. It serves only the powerful, and it's being advanced by the powerful. The powerful understand the primacy of narrative control. They understand that they are vastly outnumbered by the rank and file public, and their continued rule is therefore entirely dependent on their ability to control how people are thinking, speaking, acting, and voting. These rollouts of corporate and state power collaborating to control speech are not a response to a threat to democracy, they're a response to a threat to narrative control. These rollouts of corporate and state power collaborating to control speech are not a response to a threat to democracy, they're a response to a threat to narrative control. From Taibbi's aforementioned article. In my mind, this argument became complicated in 2017 when the Senate Intelligence Committee dragged Facebook, Twitter, and Google to the Hill and essentially ordered them to come up with a mission statement explaining how they would prevent the fomenting of discord.
Ooh, that gives me the heebie-jeebies.
It's right there in black and white. Censor speech to prevent discord. This coordination between corporate and state power to censor speech has gotten more and more egregious ever since, just as it was designed to be. Government power has been threatening online platforms like Google and Facebook with antitrust cases in order to ensure compliance with government power from them, and as long as these platforms bow to the pressure and keep expanding the censorship regime that is designed to protect imperial power structures, they'll probably be safe. Here's a Caitlin Johnstone tweet. You hear free market types saying if people don't like big tech censorship, they should just start their own social media corporation to compete with it. People have tried that and always failed because they don't collaborate with existing power structures. It doesn't work. In other words, it's a government monopoly. You can't reach billionaire levels of influence and wealth control in the current system without collaborating with existing power structures. If your collaboration isn't trusted, you'll find yourself targeted like TikTok and WeChat. This is why all the libertarians and free market types who say Silicon Valley censorship can be fought by moving to a different platform are false. No platform is going to be allowed to rise to the level of Facebook, Twitter, or YouTube unless it aligns itself with the same power structures that are pushing censorship on those platforms. This is why attempts to compete with them keep failing. These platforms were built with the help of establishment power structures, and they are maintained with the consent of those power structures. A few giant platforms sucking up all human conversation to then censor those conversations in alignment with establishment interests is an extremely valuable asset to the powerful, and they're not going to let it go easily. It's an extremely effective weapon against dissident thought. First, the wealthy controlled the newspapers, then they controlled the radio, then they controlled television, now they control online speech. It's been the same story for centuries, and in each instance, they collaborated with existing power structures to protect the status quo upon which their kingdoms were built. They did this because they understood the real secret of power, that whoever controls the narrative controls the world. Humanity will only transition into a healthy, collaborative way of functioning on this planet when everyone else awakens to this truth as well. Kate's second article is called Every Presidential Election Since the Iraq War Has Featured Candidates Who Supported It. The most powerful government on Earth still hasn't had a single presidential election that doesn't feature a prominent candidate who supported one of the most evil things that government has ever done. The United States has done many, many profoundly evil things throughout its history, but the 2003 invasion of Iraq is surely in the top 10. It killed over 1 million human beings, destabilized an entire region, led to the rise of ISIS and al-Nusra, and facilitated a rush of new Middle Eastern interventionism, all to no benefit for the American people whatsoever, and is utterly unforgivable. Yet there have been no consequences for it. no real changes of any kind were made to American military, governmental, political, or media institutions to ensure that a similar atrocity never happens again, because the drivers of U.S. foreign policy had every intention of doing it again. There weren't even any real political consequences for it, as evidenced by the fact that politicians who supported it have been ascending to Democratic and Republican presidential nominee status ever since. This is insane. The fact that every electoral contest for commander-in-chief of the most powerful military in the history of civilization has featured at least one candidate who supported one of the most evil things ever done in the blood-soaked history of their nation is too insane to really put into words. And it says so much about the state of the U.S. political system today. The current Democratic presidential nominee is a particularly egregious example of this fact, having not just supported the Iraq invasion, but played a leading role in pushing it through. Current Affairs explains, in 2003, Biden was a senator bullish about the push to war in Iraq who helped sell the Bush administration's pitch to the American public, who voted for and helped advance the Bush agenda. He was the war's most crucial Senate supporter. Biden repeated the myth that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, saying that these weapons must be dislodged from Saddam Hussein, or Saddam Hussein must be dislodged from power. The resulting war was one of the most deadly catastrophes in the history of U.S. foreign policy. The Iraqi death toll was in the hundreds of thousands, or possibly even the millions, and 4,500 American troops died. And that's just the dead. Countless more were left permanently maimed to suffer with PTSD for the rest of their lives. For every dead person, there is a family who will struggle forever to get over their loss. This is no trivial issue. In selecting a commander-in-chief, you want someone who doesn't launch catastrophic wars of aggression. Before Biden, it was Hillary Clinton, who as a U.S. senator not only voted in support of the Iraq War, but emphatically promoted it on the Senate floor, and then more than a year after the invasion, said she had no regrets about doing so. No, I don't regret giving the president authority because at the time it was in the context of weapons of mass destruction, grave threats to the United States, and clearly, Saddam Hussein had been a real problem for the international community for more than a decade, Clinton told Larry King in April 2004. Unlike Clinton and Biden, their opponent Donald Trump was in no position to actively facilitate the Iraq invasion since he wasn't in politics at the time. But in 2002, he was asked point blank by Howard Stern, "Are you for invading Iraq?" And he answered in the affirmative. If Trump was unable to see Iraq clearly from the political sidelines at the time, there's no reason to believe he'd have done any better than Biden and Clinton had he been a sitting U.S. senator in 2002 with the immense pressures to conform that were being implemented by the Bush administration. Before them, it was Republican nominee Mitt Romney in 2012 who had previously said in a 2008 Republican primary debate that it was the right decision to go into Iraq. I supported it at the time, I support it now. This was long after all the facts were in, and it had been obvious for years from even an amoral cost-to-benefit analysis that the Iraq invasion was a disaster based on lies that caused mountains more problems than it solved. Before that, it was John McCain in 2008 who, during his miserable, psychopathic excuse for a life, supported invading not just Iraq, but damn near everyone else as well. And in 2004, it was John Kerry running against the butcher himself, George W. Bush, who had just voted in support of Bush's war in 2002. The more you think about it, the more outrageous it becomes. The most powerful elected official in the most powerful government on earth with the most powerful military force the world has ever seen should not be prone to making horrifically evil decisions, and it's insane that this even needs to be said. The way principled leftists and anti-imperialists are shamed as privileged and petty whenever they point out the record of a candidate on this crucial matter is disgusting. This is not some kind of pedantic quibble. It's the bare minimum requirement for such an immensely powerful position. The argument that the Iraq invasion was supported by most prominent politicians at the time is not a defense of those politicians, it's an indictment of mainstream American politics. Nobody who supported the Iraq invasion should be working in politics at all. They shouldn't be able to find employment anywhere more prominent or influential than a cash register. It's entirely legitimate for any voter to reject anyone who supported the unforgivable invasion of Iraq, and indeed to reject the entire political system that gave rise to them. So, dear listeners and viewers, you understand what we're up against, right? Even if the words that Caitlyn Johnstone speaks might end up getting her killed someday, and even if us spreading her word around might get us killed someday, we need to do this job. We need to fight against the BBC. We need to fight against our own mainstream media. We need to fight against the hegemony of the United States government and the plutocrats who fund it. We need a revolution. We need to protest in the streets. We need to burn shit up and burn shit down. We need to turn this fucking government upside down and overthrow it. And then we need to form a true democratic government. But if, like John Brown, we're killed in the process, so be it. This is serious stuff, folks. Without our liberty, what do we have?